And welcome to this episode 245 of Europe Calling, today in cooperation with Greenpeace International and the Coalition Against SLAPs in Europe. My name is Maximilian Fries,
My
your
name
chair
is
of the Europe
Maximilian
Calling
Fries. I'm the
Committee.
Managing Director of
Tonight,
Europe
we'll focus on
Calling.
our
I would like to
discussions on
extend a
the
special
United
welcome to our
States and
guests,
Africa.
whom I will introduce in more
Those
detail in a
who see it,
moment.
not
Before we
from the other
begin, a few
side of
quick
the world, but in
announcements.
our
We will
fine
mainly be speaking
English
English
speaking
today.
body, the
If you need
Ministers of
assistance,
Zusammenarbeit haben die
we
eine
have
Frage
two
an die
interpreters.
Dolmetscherin
You can
und dann
select your
würde
language
ich
under the
nochmal
small
eine
globe in the
Interpretation
control
Frage
bar.
auswählen und seht ja gleich nochmal im Chat. And now I'm switching into English and probably stay there for the rest of the evening. With my service announcements. And as always, with Europe Calling, you can ask your questions and rate the questions with us. Today, we are using Slido for this, and you will see the link to it in the chat. Feel free to ask your questions and rate the question of others. We have now closing actually on 1,000 registrations, and this is the only way we can ask the questions that interest you. And thanks to my colleague Amelie in the background to help with the questions. And very important, if you ask the question, please do include your name. It's much nicer when I don't have to keep saying anonymous user because I can do that once and then maybe twice and then I will mess it up. And right, you will get the link to that. And as always, Europe Calling will be recorded and then posted online on YouTube and as podcast. Please keep that in mind when asking questions. And that's all for the service announcements. And we get going. I will introduce our guests. We have actually six fantastic speakers, and I'm really, really glad that I'm the only man on this panel. You will see in the next 90 minutes. That is quite rare, and that's pretty fantastic. And I will introduce them in the order they will appear. And I will just give you the basics because they really don't need me to introduce themselves. So we will start with Sana Ghotbi, who's co-allyship lead at Greenpeace International, and Daisy Ruddock, who is coordinator for the Coalition Against SLAPs in Europe. Daisy and Sana will introduce today's topic. And next, then, will be three testimonies from Nawosha Szymborska, environmental activist, last generation member of Last Generation Poland, and guestivist of and the Guestivist Collective. And many things you will explain to us. Casey Valente, senior legal project manager at Greenpeace International, and Tina Urso, chief operating officer of the Daphne Caruana Galizia Foundation. So great to have you three and hear your testimonies. And we will then round this up with a look into what's next with Flutura Kusari, who's a senior legal advisor at the European Center for Press and Media Freedom. And then Sana Ghotbi again to close this up with Daisy together as well on campaigning questions. And there's quite a lot of input. We're gonna have maybe some questions in between, but then afterwards we definitely have time for a good number of questions from your side. So I'm really excited about this panel. This is one of the topics I really know very little about, so I'm really looking forward to learn a lot myself. And with that, I shut up and hand over to Daisy and Sana for the introduction.
Thank you very much, Max, and hello, everyone. Just like Max said, I work for Greenpeace International as co-allyship lead. And right now, what we're up against as Greenpeace International is a massive slap suit that we got from the oil pipeline company Energy Transfer. And my colleague Casey is going to talk more about that case. Some of you might have heard about it in the news. And Daisy will also explain a little bit more about what SLAPs actually means. Basically, it's in our case, corporations going against activists for trying to speak out against harm on people and planets. And this goes very much in line with what the trend that we're seeing around the world right now in governments becoming more authoritarian. We see the biggest rise of autocracy that we've seen in a long while, where with over 70% of people right now living in autocracies and a huge democratic backslide. And corporations, big tech, and governments are very much colluding with each other in repression of activists, journalists, farmers, unions, workers, regular people who are just trying to live their lives, and those that dare to speak out when they see corporations and governments repressing people and hurting the planet. For example, oil companies, mining companies, etc. A lot of the work that I'm doing together with Casey currently is documenting testimonies from those that have been affected by corporate intimidation. And the stories that we hear are It's so extreme. We are talking to people from all over the world who the only thing that they've done is trying to, for example, farm their own land, and an oil company comes along and destroys their land, takes their homes away from them, and when they try to speak out, the company sue them and they drown them in legal costs, forces them into a lot of health issues, and utterly destroys their lives. And this is just some examples of what we see are happening. So this is why we really wanted to talk about this topic together with Europe Calling and CASE, an amazing coalition that has done so much important work against these type of corporate intimidation, specifically SLAPs. And we think that civil society needs to protect itself and know about these threats. And we're hoping that through this webinar, you can learn more about what SLAPs are, how to protect yourselves, and also the current direction that the EU is going with a new directive against SLAPs, and what we as Europeans living in Europe can do to pressure our governments. And so I'm so thrilled to be here with you, and I'm passing over to Daisy to speak a little bit more about SLAPs and CASE as well.
Thank you. Hi everyone. Yes, as Sana and Max said, I'm Daisy. I'm on the policy and campaigns team for the organisation Index on Censorship. And since September 2024, I've also been the coordinator for the Coalition Against SLAPs in Europe, also known as CASE. So I'm just going to give a brief intro to SLAPs and then a quick overview of the CASE Coalition and what we do. So CASE is a coalition made up of European non-profit organisations from various spheres. So we have organisations that work in journalism, environmental advocacy, human rights, whistleblower protection, and the legal sector, amongst others. And the one thing that unites all of the organisations within this coalition is the desire to fight back against SLAPs, which stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. And that is what we're here to talk about today. So, put simply, a SLAP is an abusive lawsuit which is filed by a private party with the purpose of silencing critical speech. So, essentially, it's a tool used by powerful actors such as corporations, public officials, or business people. And they are aimed at intimidating and ultimately silencing anyone who speaks out on issues of public interest. And the goal is to saddle defendants with expensive, time-consuming and stressful legal cases to essentially shut them up, really. So they can impact anybody, but common targets include journalists, academics, activists, whistleblowers, and civil society organizations. They threaten freedom of speech, but also access to information, rule of law, and democracy itself. So CASE is fighting against this phenomenon. We have currently 124 member organisations from across Europe, and we're growing every year. And we also have 22 national working groups set up in different countries across the continent. And these national coalitions have become increasingly important since the EU anti-SLAPP directive was passed last year, which I think you'll be hearing more about later in this webinar. So that kind of sets the scene for what CASE is today and gives you the idea of the context that we're working in. So at CASE, we take a threefold approach to fighting SLAPs, advocacy campaigns, and legal resilience. And we kind of rely on all of these things in tandem to fight against SLAPs. So in order to effectively tackle SLAPs, we need solidarity and collaboration, and we will be speaking a lot more about why this is important with the rest of this webinar. So yeah, that's hopefully a very, very brief roundup of the coalition and our activities. And I will pass back to Max to introduce our first speaker.
Yeah, thank you so much for this very concise introduction. And we're going to start with the testimonies, and we are starting with Poland, with Nawojka Szyborska, who is, as I said, a member, a gastivist, member of the Last Generation Poland, and generally a climate and eco-activist. And we're really looking forward to hear your story, Nawojka.
Hi everyone, thank you. I'm really honored to be speaking to such a large audience today. Let me just share my screen. It's just gonna be a few pictures because I feel like it's nicer when you have something to look at, especially that this story is quite a visual one. So let me just clarify with the names first. I am working with the International Gustavist Collective, and by that collective, I was hired to set up a local anti-gas resistance in Poland. So in Poland, I started working with local activists, and we called ourselves Bombelki. So that is the name that you're gonna see in some of these pictures. But since then, Bombelki changed their name to Last Generation, hence the third name. But basically, this story starts in summer of 2022 in Warsaw, where we did this action that you see on the picture. It's by the Vistula Boulevard. This is a guerrilla projection that we did on the building of the Center of Science, where we basically projected these images that are saying to stop the building of a new gas terminal in Gdańsk, which is a Polish city where this project is planned. And other things about how gas is a new coal when it comes to the climate impact, how methane leaks are causing the climate crisis, and basically how gas is a no good solution or alternative. And this action was primarily targeting this major gas company, Gaz-System. So this is a state-owned company, and they are the main operator of the whole gas infrastructure in Poland. So they are also responsible for building these new gas terminals. And I wrote an article about this action, and Green News, which is like a small kind of activist newspaper, published this article, which was basically just kind of explaining what the action was and what was meant behind it. And there's then like an infamous quote that I used from one of the activists, which is that Gaz-System, the company, is a bunch of criminals who lead us towards a catastrophe for their own profit. And I'm saying an infamous quote because I got sued, and the newspaper also got sued for this exact quote, or at least they claimed that this is for this exact quote. Our interpretation is obviously that it was just about targeting them in an action because this is a company that was never in public spotlight before. We were the first activist group to kind of start going against them. So this is how it looked like on the website where the article was posted, and we had to put this little frame where we explained that the company, Gaz-System, is questioning our claim that Gaz-System is a bunch of criminals. So this was kind of funny. But basically, this lawsuit was for a protection of personal rights. And they asked us to delete the article, apologize, and pay 20,000 zlotys, which is like 5,000 euros. So you can imagine this was a bit scary at first because at the time I was a student, I was 19, and then this newspaper is also not a big one, it's really like community-led. So obviously we don't have this amount of money, and we're going against this huge state-owned corporation. So there was a big possibility that it would have a chilling effect on us because the lawsuit itself was like 200 pages. I could barely read. Fortunately, and this is the solidarity that Daisy mentioned, Helsinki Foundation of Human Rights decided to represent us. And this was like the biggest breakthrough that allowed us to kind of have this confidence that we are being protected. We are basically in good hands, and we can just do what we do best, which is campaigning. So what we did was we have to try to scandalize this lawsuit. You can see the pictures of me in my bleached blonde era, but this is me. So we basically just went to the press with it and we're like, you're trying to silence us, we're gonna be three times louder this time. So we did that. We also made protests. So for example, here you can see us where we went in front of Gaz-System's headquarters. And you know how there are sorry, I forgot the word. So sometimes when people have dogs, they will have these names that like the dog can be aggressive and like you shouldn't enter the property or something like this. So basically we played with this convention and we just put signs like this in front of Gaz-System's headquarters where we are saying this is a company that sues people for telling the truth about the climate. So like be aware this is an aggressive company. And basically, since then, the court, we never had a trial. The court just ordered us to go through mediations. And they basically, Gasystem withdrew their charges. So through this mediation process, we went into settlement and we never had to pay anything. So practically, the case now is sort of resolved. But there's several interpretations as to why, because I have to mention that in the meantime, like I said, it was 2022, so this case was dragging for 3 years. Our government changed in Poland to a one that's not so democratic, but at least it claims to be more democratic than the previous one. So this can be one of the arguments. But on the other hand, amazing lawyers that really did their job very well in defending us and our steadfastness, because for sure we weren't like an easy target for them after all, which probably they expected at first. But we just started going louder, and the case started having more and more publicity than even the original article. So that's why we basically, I feel like, didn't make it easy for them, and they decided to back up practically. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Very inspiring and a very good example and very good testimony of what we are talking today. So great start. Oh wait, I made this, yeah, like smaller again. So just don't want to comment too much on it. So I think we will do that after and then speak with each other. So you and Wojciech will stay here also if you have questions on the actions and everything. And I would just want to move to our second testimony from Casey Valente, Senior Legal Project Manager at Greenpeace International. And I think we go over the big pond now from Poland to the United States. So Casey, great to have you, and we're looking forward to your testimony.
Thanks so much. I am grateful to be here and talk to everyone about energy transfer in the Greenpeace International and Greenpeace entities in the US legal cases. Great. So I'm going to start with a little background. A lot of people have heard about the energy transfer and Greenpeace cases, but maybe not everyone. So I'll keep it high level, but let's start with why we have these lawsuits. So in 2016 and 2017, Energy Transfer, a pipeline corporation in the United States, built the Dakota Access Pipeline. The construction near and under a place called the Missouri River triggered months of indigenous-led resistance and protests by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and what they called themselves as water protectors, fighting for the protection and safety of their water supply. Energy Transfer claims that the Greenpeace organizations in the United States and Greenpeace International, the organization that Sana and I work for, manufactured the resistance and spread disinformation to investors, ending up, the result costing them millions of dollars. So, what did the Greenpeace entities, what was our participation at the Standing Rock protests? So, at the request of Indigenous leaders, the Greenpeace entities in the United States donated about $15,000 so for the purpose of nonviolent direct action training that was done by an Indigenous organization called IP3. Greenpeace USA also delivered some supplies to the resistance camp. They brought their solar van, which provided some like charging capabilities and some infrastructure to the camp. And they sent a handful of team members there. Greenpeace International, meantime, as an entity based in the Netherlands, we didn't do anything physically. We were not in North Dakota at the resistance camp. The only thing we did was sign a letter by another NGO in the Netherlands called BankTrack. Some of you may have heard of BankTrack. And that letter was, we were among over 500 organizations that signed that letter. It was asking lenders to suspend loan payments to Energy Transfer until the conflict with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe was resolved. So, and I have been at Greenpeace International and worked in the legal unit for over 9 years now, and I have worked on our legal defense since the first case from Energy Transfer, and that case was filed in August of 2017. It was a federal case where Energy Transfer sued the two entities, the Greenpeace entities in the US and Greenpeace International and BankTrack and others in federal court. The complaint alleged violations of RICO Act, and RICO is an acronym. It stands for Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations. So it's a statute or a federal law in the United States that's meant to address business enterprises and organized crime. So when RICO is used, it's usually used for like mobsters or gangs, things like that. So it is a common technique that we see used in the United States with slap suits. And this was also the case in this federal slap. So while they filed this suit against us, they also launched a publicity campaign. Their CEO, Kelsey Warren, stated on a very big television program in the United States that the objective was not to recover costs or monetary compensation, but to send a message. In February of 2019, our motion to dismiss this case was granted, stating that the evidence was far short of what was needed, especially on that RICO complaint. But the judge declined jurisdiction over the state law. That meant Energy Transfer could file another lawsuit in North Dakota State. And they did that. So within a week, they sued the three entities again, Greenpeace US and Greenpeace International. And those complaints now in the North Dakota State Court were trespass, conversion, aiding and abetting, what we call ground torts. Also, there were defamation. So there were nine statements identified on three different themes. And I think that's an important thing to mention. Those themes were, did the pipeline cross tribal land? And what we said about that, whether they desecrated cultural sites in building that pipeline, and did they use force against peaceful protests? There were also claims for tortious interference and conspiracy. There was a trial before a jury in Morton County, North Dakota. We noted jury bias. We also noticed there was some very suspicious activity happening with targeting the jury pool with different publications that were bringing back things that had happened during the protests that were definitely highlighting anti-environmental work, things like that. Our calls to move to a different venue because we felt that the jury, this was unfair to ask this community to create a jury to decide this, we were denied. And so the trial did move forward. Eventually, the jury awarded $666 million against the three Greenpeace organizations. Of that $666 million, $132 million was against Greenpeace International. That's the jury verdict. We don't have a judgment yet, so we cannot appeal this yet. There is still a lot of motions happening, what we call post-trial motions, where both sides are arguing. Energy Transfer feels that that verdict should be higher. We feel that it should be thrown out. So all of we're starting to get those decisions in the post-trial motions and moving forward towards an appeal, which we see as inevitable. And that appeal will go to the North Dakota Supreme Court. So that will be our next venue. Meanwhile, though, Greenpeace International has taken forward an anti-slap suit in the Netherlands. So this is a proactive legal strategy that we're doing to push back against Energy Transfer and the slap suits that they've brought against us in the United States. We're using Article 17 of the new EU anti-slap directive. And that article states that an organization or a person that is in one of the member states who is slapped by a third country, or in this case, the United States, should be able to sue that perpetrator for damages and costs. So we saw the opportunity to do this. And so in July of 2024, we demanded that Energy Transfer drop the slap in North Dakota. That was before the trial, and accept liability. They refused. So in October of 2024, we received news that the Dutch government had almost no changes to the Dutch law, meaning that the transposition of the EU anti-slap directive was very much already in place or very close to it, including that Article 17, which was the article we were using in this case. That meant we could move forward with this legal case. So in February of 2025, before the trial in North Dakota started, we summoned Energy Transfer, three of the entities that are part of the Energy Transfer family, before the Amsterdam District Court. And there was a deadline for them to appear, which was the 2nd of July. Bum, bum, bum. What are we asking for with this case? We're asking for a declaration that both the federal and the state slap suits that we have been fighting are wrongful. They are wrongful towards Greenpeace International and their abuse of rights. We want an award of the damages and the cost that we've spent defending ourselves since 2017 in both of these cases. We want an order that Energy Transfer has to publish the judgment and a press release clarifying it acted unlawfully towards Greenpeace International, with a daily penalty if they don't do that. Well, Energy Transfer isn't just, of course, showing up in Dutch court and politely defending themselves. They actually initially ignored the case, and we did not think they were going to participate in the Dutch proceedings. But on the 22nd of July, they did appoint Dutch counsel. They have now filed a defense. We've just this week responded to that defense. So this case is very much in play right now. But while all of that was happening in the Netherlands, Energy Transfer asked the judge in North Dakota to stop this case from moving forward. So they filed what was called an anti-suit injunction, asking the court to intervene and say that we could not continue this case. The judge denied that anti-suit injunction. So our case continues to move forward. Energy Transfer is not happy about that, and they have appealed that decision to the Supreme Court in North Dakota. And these things are very fresh and happening right now. So we are expecting a trial in early December in front of the North Dakota Supreme Court for them to hear that appeal and for us to say that that request should continue to be denied. Like I mentioned, we've just responded to their defense, and there are some things there, some bullets about what their preliminary defense categories are in the case. But what does this all mean? What is this case in the United States against a Dutch NGO and US NGOs mean to all of you? And I think that mostly that $6 million, $666 million verdict struck a chord. And we know that slaps are not new. Environmental defenders and human rights defenders, journalists have been targeted for many, many years. But this is definitely a case where it isn't just Greenpeace. It's bigger than that. And that is why the Time to Resist campaign at Greenpeace has become so big and why it exists. It's a fight that's bigger than us. It's a call for solidarity. It is how billionaires and corporate polluters, especially big oil, but not only big oil, try to silence us. And it's because we're standing up to them, and it's because they know protest works. So you've heard it's not just an attack on us, but on civil society movements. An attack on one is an attack on all. And it's important that we stand together, because anyone who dares to speak out could face cases like this and other forms of intimidation. It doesn't matter if it's just environmental groups. This is regardless of ideology or political affiliation. It's a threat to anyone when someone that criticizes or opposes someone else is silenced through the legal through weaponization of the legal system. And no matter what happens in the courtroom, we know that our movement will only grow stronger. We know that they can try to stop us, but they cannot stop the movement. And I know we're going to talk about some other ways that we can work together and show forms of solidarity and what we see on the horizon at Greenpeace International. And I think that's it for me. Thank you so much for hearing about the Energy Transfer case and our fight. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. This is, I think it's really, really inspiring. It's also a really good story. I'm feeling a documentary coming up as soon as you won this, and I'm sure you will. So thank you so much, and I'm sure there will be much to discuss and many questions and many lessons learned from that case. And of course, fingers crossed that will turn out all well, and you will win. And I'm going to the third testimony, and that is from Tina Urso. She's Chief Operating Officer of the Daphne Caruana Galizia Foundation, and I'm really happy to have you here. Also, a very personal side note, when I started to work in the European Parliament back in 2017, this was just weeks before Daphne was murdered in Malta. So really, that kind of defined a quite a big and important part, that moment defined a big and important part of my political work at this in the European Parliament. So it's like, it's very personal that you're here today, and I'm really glad and grateful that you are, Tina.
Thank you so much, Max, and I'm very grateful to be here today. So yes, I mean, well, with Daphne Caruana Galizia, by the time of her assassination, which was in October 2017, she was facing an extraordinary wave of libel and defamation suits. So it was between 35 and 40 libel cases. The important thing that has to be said about these cases is that their goal was not to seek justice, but it was their objective was to drain her financially, to drain her mentally. They were used as a form of intimidation. And that is what, these cases after years of advocacy are what we refer to as slaps today. At the time, slaps was not a word that was coined in Europe. It is something that was used in the US, but not yet in Europe. And it is the work after she was assassinated, this is the work that the family and the foundation, together with a lot of our colleagues at media freedom organizations, advocated for. I mean, and it's rather than touching on one specific case Daphne was facing, kind of it's good to focus on the common trends they had, So to give you an example of one specific case that she was facing was against Silvio da Buono, who is a well-known businessman in Malta, businessman in tourism and property development. So he sued her 19 times. So he opened 19 different cases for 19 sentences in one article. Obviously, you can tell that the objective of these cases was not to, seek justice or clear his name in any way, but it was rather to scare her, to intimidate. She was facing cases from the former prime minister at the time, Joseph Muscat, ex-ministers, energy minister Konrad Mitzi, the ex-chief of staff to the prime minister, Keech Kembri. She was also facing another two or three cases for the then opposition leader at the time. So it wasn't even cases that came from, specifically only government, or she was facing these sort of cases from every across the board. After Daphne was assassinated, the foundation started documenting these cases together with Flutura, who is here on the panel today from ECPMF. There was also Article 19, Reporters Without Borders. A lot of media freedom organizations came together and started documenting cases. And it is when we noticed a pattern of cases filed against public participation, with the objective to silence and intimidate. All across Europe, journalists and activists were being hit with similar abusive lawsuits that Daphne was facing. And that is where CASE, which Daisy is co a coordinator of, as she mentioned earlier, was created. And the objective of CASE was to make sure that journalists and activists and anyone facing slaps in Europe are not left alone. It was a coalition created to support SLAP targets, whether it is financially or whether it is through advocacy or through any support, campaigning support, any support that they require. And that is how, I mean, it is the advocacy of case for the anti-SLAP directive, that is how Daphne's Law came about. I mean, I want to say that, you know, the government in Malta did really wanted to honor Daphne with Daphne's Law, but unfortunately, whilst Malta, yes, was the first country to transpose that the SLAP directive into legislation, it is also the weakest. If we had to look at the law that we, the SLAP law that we have in Malta, it would have not protected Daphne from most of the cases that she was facing before she was killed. You know, while it should have been the first, it should have been the first to transpose the strongest and comprehensive anti-SLAP law rather than, you know, the first to transpose the weakest. So yes, it did. Malta did very little beyond the bare minimum required from the European Commission, and this is my call to action to everyone on this webinar today. You know, to push your governments to transpose the best legislation so that we are able to protect journalists, activists, lawyers, academics, anyone facing slaps in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And maybe because you didn't note, you didn't mention at the beginning, and I noticed that we might be speaking among ourselves, but the people might not remember actually what happened back in 2017. So you can maybe can you say, you know,
yes, of course.
Your quick summary of actually, you know, who Daphne was and what actually happened to her. And I think there has been now also convictions and that. So maybe just a very quick background,
yes,
because
of
I'm not
course.
sure people might not know.
Definitely. So Daphne Caruana Galizia was a journalist in Malta. She exposed a lot of stories on corruption, I mean environmental destruction. In October 2017, she was killed in a car bomb. Currently, the alleged mastermind is in court waiting for trial. Those who planted the bomb have been already sentenced earlier this year, but there is still no trial date in sight for the mastermind. And the foundation was created following her assassination by her family. And the mission of the foundation is to push for, you know, media freedom, anti-corruption. We support journalists in Malta doing that work, so, and also journalists internationally as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for that and for your important work. And it was, I think it was also maybe to pull it a bit wider, I think also Daphne's assassination was kind of the beginning of something there. I think Kushniak's murder in Slovakia was next. Mr. Kushniak and his partner were then killed, I think, the year after, or just a couple of
yes,
months
exactly.
later, essentially. And also there were also targets of SLAP. So this was 2017 and 2018. This was a time where those two assassinations happened in very short order, and that changed a lot.
Exactly.
In this season. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, when we, you know, Daphne, although she faced a lot of slaps and intimidation, she never gave in. You know, there were a lot of, and ultimately, this is the way they've managed to silence her. And yes, of course, this is it's something to keep in mind. You know that journalists and activists are, you know, persistent, and we can, and this is why good legislations on slaps is so important, because we need to protect those who are, you know, exposing truth.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's what we're trying also to do today, at least a bit of it, and you're all doing this this in a fantastic work. Actually, people, before we go into what's next, people that know Europe Calling a bit know that my mother tends to join quite a lot, and she always gives me the best comments. And she just wrote to me actually. So hi, mom. She wrote to me, "What a fantastic and lovely woman you have with you today." And I think this goes for all of us. So thank you for your fantastic contributions. And with that, we go into like the third part of it, and that's on what's next. And for that, we will first hear from Flutura Kusari, Senior Legal Advisor at the European Center for Press and Media Freedom.
Hi, thank you very much. It's great to join this event. I'll try to. So first, I just introduce myself. I work as a senior legal advisor for the ECPMF. I am here, I think, because of the work that I did jointly with many colleagues in Europe on SLAPs. I had the privilege of being one of the co-founders of Coalition Against SLAPs in Europe. I was a member of steering committee until April. Before that, we were working already in the topic of supporting journalists, but not so much on SLAPs. So I wanted to use the minutes I have maybe to address 4 points, and I'll try to stay either within a limit of time or shorter because I know we also want topics questions from the audience. So first, just to follow up on what Tina said, personally, my work at ECPMF is usually to provide legal support for journalists who are facing legal challenges. These include defamation lawsuits, GDPR, copyright, but also arrest and detention. So it's a lot of paperwork and analysis. But I also go in the field in the sense of conducting advocacy missions when there are legal elements. I traveled to Malta when Daphne was assassinated. It was also a personal decision because I was touched, like everyone who heard about this case. It doesn't matter whether didn't matter whether we knew her or not. And as I was staying in Malta, I tried to understand a bit more who Daphne was. And there was a lot of information being shared. She was a very high-profile, known journalist, a very courageous. She had very good sources, and that's why she shaped basically the public discussion. But there was this information that I received from many people I spoke that she was really suffering from the fact that she had so many defamation lawsuits, which in practice it meant that she didn't have time to do what she wanted to do, which is journalism. She ended up going very regularly in court, and before you go to court, as you know, you need to spend a lot of time preparing. So that was something that was really bothering her. And at the same time, if you read her blog, which is still there, you can see that she already started to talk about SLAPs, not naming them SLAPs per se, but the impact it is having on other journalists and media outlets, how information was being pulled out from online. And from the public domain. So what happened after Malta? A group of us, around five people, we started just to discuss. Basically, these were phone calls after our working hours. We wanted to know whether this was a problem in Europe, whether this was happening only to Daphne or journalists in Malta. And we realized from the initial research, very limited research, that this was a problem not only in Malta, but in a lot of countries, but that there was something that was basically contributing in keeping this not a secret, but it was not an information that was in public domain that was discussed by as it deserved to be discussed. And the reason was mainly the fear from being sued if you refer to either legal threats or to actual lawsuits. So we started to collect information. I always say if it wasn't for Daphne's family, we wouldn't come so far, meaning having European standards on SLAPs. Because journalists, when we phone journalists, when we ask them to share information, they were very hesitant, and it was Matthew, his brothers, Tina, Daphne's sister, basically calling journalists around Europe saying, please, if you're being sued and you think it's baseless, share this story. And this is how we started to document. As soon as we had information that this was indeed a European problem, the next stage for us was to seek European solutions. So we contacted, so at the same time, civil society was coming together. We were reaching out to journalists, media outlets, civil society organizations, saying to everyone, please join us. Let's address this topic in Europe. And at the same time, we reached out to European Commission, European Parliament, and Council of Europe as the main European institutions who could do something. I think all of you who work especially on advocacy know that if you don't have politicians who believe in media freedom, in fundamental rights, in democracy, you can complain day and night. You can do the best strategies in the world. Nothing will happen. We were, I think, very lucky in the sense that what a tragic case of Daphne being murdered was used by first from the family not to leave her what she did and the work that I have my daughter around, so she's playing with the lights. So the family committed to use what happened to Daphne and to make sure that that doesn't happen to other journalists, and use that to get a lot of commitments from politicians, European politicians, that to address slaps. So we asked, to cut a very long story short, because we worked on this more than half a decade, we asked the European Commission to put in place a directive on a directive. We prepared a model law together with experts from Aberdeen University. And what you see now, the EU directive, it's not ideal, it's not what we were hoping, but it's a good piece of legislation. We asked the Council of Europe to come up with a what we called at that time self-standing recommendation to say this recommendation is for the member states on slaps. This is how it should be addressed. And now we have two very strong instruments. So the next stage is implementation. So what we've done is we've put together with CASE and ECPMF an anti-slap monitor. I will share the link here. Whenever you have a time, you can have a look. So now the all members of the European Union and Council of Europe members have the obligation to put in place legislation so that international standards can be implemented at a national level. So for non-lawyers, that means that when these European institutions create standards, let's say a slap lawsuit needs to be dismissed early in court, then for that standard to be implemented at national level, you need to either amend existing legislation or to put forward new legislation. So what we have so far is one bad example from Malta, as Tina mentioned, and we have around 20 initiatives from 20 governments to transpose and implement these standards in practice. There is a deadline, May next year, from the European Commission for these standards to be implemented at national level. There is no deadline for Council of Europe, but we're using the European Commission deadline to ask member states to come forward. Generally speaking, we are seeing two approaches. You have some countries in Europe, not many, unfortunately, like Poland. I would like to mention Poland, although there is some criticism from civil society. I'm very familiar with what's happening there. Poland has put in place an anti-slap law, which addresses both domestic and cross-border slaps. And civil society and groups are being consulted, not in the best way possible, but they have a say in that. Plus, they have consulted Council of Europe. We will have to see. But if the work goes as it started, we should have a good piece of legislation in place. But you also have countries like I mentioned Malta and some countries that I don't want to mention now, which are doing all this in a very hidden way without independent experts, without a civil society. And my fear is that in practice, this is being done just to say, you know, we transpose the directive, that's it, not because they want to protect a journalist. Now, the question is, again, for non-lawyers, if 7 years ago we were at a situation, or 8 years ago, when Daphne and others were being sued based on of initiatives of powerful people abusing procedures, what has changed? The main thing that has changed is that until now, judges, prosecutors, but also people working in administrative bodies, they did not have the necessary laws and regulations which would enable them to quickly dismiss slap cases. So this is the biggest achievement that we've had. Now the standards say that, okay, if I am a journalist, if I write an article against a critical of a journal of a businessman, and the businessman wants to sue me, he or she or a businesswoman, they can do so. But courts should have the right, as soon as they see that the case is a slap, to dismiss it quickly. And what is achieved by this is that first, you make sure that a journalist or a slap victim does not spend time and money in the case, but it also discourages those who want to abuse procedures not to do so. This is not to say that they will not find other creative ways. They will do it. They are always 10 steps ahead of us, but that's the whole purpose. So I will conclude this first part of intervention is all of us, in whatever capacities we are, we need to engage with ministries of justice and to push them to A, come forward with legislative. Quality of law is basically good, that they aim for higher standards, not for the minimum standards. Because once a legislation is adopted, especially in countries where civil procedural codes are being amended, there is no way back. It takes a lot of political will to amend the rules. So this is the best moment, especially for civil society, to intervene. That's it from me in this first intervention. Thanks.
Much and actually, thanks so much. And before we actually go into Sana and Daisy and campaigning, we have a direct question here for you, Flutura, which is from Harald. And Harald asked, Malta clearly has one of the weakest anti-slap regulations. Harald says, from what he understood, could you provide an overview of the anti-slap regulations in the EU and also compare them with those in the US and in Canada? For example, so I think you alluded to it a bit, but can you maybe try to paint a picture for Harold?
I cannot compare with US and Canada because I don't know the legislation there. I know that they are way ahead of us, but I am not familiar, so I don't think it's fair to speak about a topic that I don't know. So before we had these instruments in place, legislation in Europe, we had provisions here and there, which were, generally speaking, not used. For example, in a lot of legislation at national level, there are provisions saying that the court does not allow abuse of procedures. But then when we looked at the case law, we did not find enough arguments to say, okay, Hana, we did not find enough evidence to say, look, there is existing legislation and that can be used. Now we have the standards. We have only one country which passed anti-slap legislation, and all other countries, around 20, they are at the stage of drafting it. And so we should be able, if you look at the website that I sent, there you will see who started the transposition and who didn't start, and there are countries where we don't have information. The first stage of work for a case is to collect how the transposition is going, which is a technical part. And then in the website, you will see that there are some stars. Our idea is that as soon as there is legislation in place, we will assess the quality of legislation. We're developing a very thorough methodology, and based on that, we will give it will be like a five-star methodology to assess countries. We're hoping that this would create a little bit of healthy competition between countries to go for higher standards. But this is the information that we have on legislation, and we have countries who are more cooperative, and we have countries which are less cooperative. To give you an example, Hungary, we've been in touch with them, and they say that the response was, be assured that Hungary is not afraid of transposing anti-slap standards, although we did not ask whether they are afraid or not, we asked other information. So depending on the democracy and the level of media freedom in different countries, that's also the response that we're receiving.
Thank you so much. And we have more questions on that, but we'll go to them later. And I want to end kind of our more frontal part of the event with Sana and Daisy. You both already know. And actually, we can hear Casey later on the US and Canada in comparison. We will do that. But I already started moderating Sana and introducing Sana and Daisy again for the outlook on the campaigning side of things. You have the floor.
Thank you, Max. And I just wanted to start by saying thank you to everyone, all of the other speakers. It's very inspiring to hear about your work. And like we have so much to thank you for, even though, as you say, the current anti-SLAPP EU directive isn't, top level and what we hope for, it shows that all of your great work has had an effect. And I think to sum up what like a lot of people have talked about, basically, it's in our hands now, right? We have the EU directive. We know that our governments aren't, most of them aren't doing anything. Either they haven't transposed it or they are on their way to do it, but not in a meaningful way. And as you know, with all government policy, it's easy for them to get away unless the people show that we care about this. We're watching you. We worry about our protections, our freedoms, our free speech. And so I think it's really important to talk about what we can do now that we have this information. And I will say I'm not a legal expert. When I started working for Greenpeace International, I didn't know what SLAPPs were. And it can sound very like hard and unclear, but when you hear about the people behind it, like Daphne, people who have been killed and murdered, who have been persecuted, it reminds you that we are talking about actual people. And this is what we are at risk if we're not doing anything about the directive, is more people being persecuted, more people not being able to raise their voice. Also, as our governments in Europe are becoming more authoritarian, there's a bigger risk for us. There's a bigger risk when US corporations can come in to Europe and sue us as well. So there's a lot of things we need to do. And we at Greenpeace International, along with Case, have had many conversations about how we can collaborate with the wider movement to do something. And one of the things that we see as important is the transposition deadline, May 9th next year. It's a symbolic date when we can pressure our governments for not holding up their end of the deal. And I think it's important that we, from different backgrounds, whether we are legal experts or not, whether we are journalists or students or just normal so-called European citizens living in Europe, I think all of us are affected. And this summer, 2nd of July, we tried to do something already at the point of when, as Casey said, Greenpeace International, we had our first administrative hearing, where we took Energy Transfer to court in Amsterdam because we have our main office there. And together with Case, we mobilized different European communities, organizations to do a day of action. So a lot of people spoke up, wrote press releases, talked to media, wrote on social media, but also went to landmarks, key landmarks, to their governments and tried to speak on this issue. And I think for the transposition deadline in May next year, we need to be louder. We need to make our governments understand that they have to take us seriously. And we propose that for those that are interested, we're going to send you more information on what the next steps are. And we invite you to join our campaign and think about how this could be in your country. And obviously, the transposition monitor that Case is working on is a perfect way for you to be able to understand what can work in your country, depending on how far your country has gone in transposing the anti-SLAPP directive. And Daisy will talk a little bit more about how you can join Case in your own country. And feel free to also contact us, both Casey and I, to talk about ideas that you might have for what we could test together. We are really willing to do something big here. I think it concerns all of our democracy. Over to you, Daisy.
Thank you. Yeah, so I mean, most of it's covered by Sana, but yeah, hopefully this webinar has kind of shown how important the fight against SLAPs is. And if you do want to get involved, then CASE always welcomes new member organizations. The only requirement is to be invested in the fight against SLAPs. You could be from any kind of sphere. As long as you're anti-SLAP, then you are welcome in the coalition. So we've also discussed how important it is to keep the pressure on at a national level, particularly with the EU directive having been passed. So with 22 different national working groups within CASE, there's also a great chance to get involved on a national level, which is just as important. So you can find details about how to join on our website. I can share our website as well on chat. And yeah, you can get in contact with the coalition through our contact email or just with me directly. And I'll be happy to walk you through some ways that you can help or join the coalition. And yeah, so if you want to get involved and join the fight against SLAPs, then please get in touch. Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you all for that. This, as Sana said, really grateful for all your hard work on that. And I think this was a really big collective effort to get to that point. And there's still a lot of the way to go. And I wanna now in the Q&A, now it's the opportunity for all of you to ask questions as well. So we don't have many actually written questions, which I would interpret as that we have such amazing speakers that actually covered all the questions in their statement, which I think that's the case. But still, there are questions. So there's still the question open here from Harald, which I kind of started, and then there was also the part of the question that was a bit of comparing to the U.S. and Canada. And Casey mentioned that at the beginning, Futura as well. So can you? So how's the legal situation in the U.S. and Canada? Is that any better or different than what the EU is doing with the SLAPP law?
Yeah, I'll jump in on the US context. There is no federal anti-SLAPP legislation. So there is some anti-SLAPP legislation state by state. I want to say it's 30 or 31 states have anti-SLAPP protection.
Oh, did we lose
Can you
Casey? Casey,
Sorry.
sorry, we lost your audio. We
Oh,
lost
no.
to the last two sentences, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe rewind 20 seconds.
Sure. So there is some state anti-SLAPP protections. I want to say 30 or 31 states have something, but it varies in terms of how the strength of that protection and how useful it is. It does allow powerful corporations to be very selective on venue and what state they want to sue different people or organizations in. In Canada, I want to say that there is also no nationwide anti-SLAPP protection. There are some provincial, I think two provinces have anti-SLAPP legislation. And I would just say that there is a coalition in the United States called Protect the Protest that is does similar work that CASE does. So one of the aspects of Protect the Protest work that I like is that there is a like a private sector sign-on, like where they have private sector pledges, a pledge not to engage in SLAPs, not to and that's I think a powerful piece of work that they do. They also have a task force and highlight different cases and different groups. You can check them out. And I would say that there is a lot of work being done on a US federal anti-SLAPP legislation, but with the current administration, we are up against quite a barrier in getting that
Yeah, I was wondering when you described what the RICO law actually does that, you in that list you missed maybe a pretty White House that that might need to be looked at as well. We're not going into detail there. That was very interesting, actually. So now I wondered also, Casey, just what you were talking is like, I wondered this 660 million, right? I mean, this is obviously for European ears in a way. This is huge because usually this is in Europe. This is very rare to have like such enormous sums on kind of on fines, penalties. I'm not sure in the UK actually, but at least in most of European cities, this is nothing you would normally see. So how would that actually work if you're winning the damages case and Amsterdam, would they actually, this is a huge sum, would they actually be able to award those damages, even though that's probably much higher than anything that's usual in the like European legal systems?
It's huge to us in the United States as
Okay,
well.
as well. Okay.
It's jaw-dropping. I mean, there are higher damage awards in the United States than in Europe by comparison, but this one is definitely a big deal. In terms of the Dutch case, so we are not suing them for these damages. We're suing them for the costs that we incurred, and basically saying that they cannot collect their damages because this lawsuit is illegal in the Netherlands. So that's the way that we are handling it.
I see. Excellent. So there's another question that is here that actually asking for how the German situation is. And I actually found I quickly Googled, and we can also get you all in. And there's actually a civil society opinion. I checked up on noslabs.eu, and then you find the legal opinion on what's happening in Germany actually. And there was one point that I posted this in German. So but there was one very critical point on the current draft for the transposition, and that is that in the German transposition, extra court, so like non-court proceedings are not covered. So like and so and it writes that in Germany it's often that it's not that you're getting sued, but you just get a letter from a lawyer, and I guess it's very similar in other countries as well. You actually get a letter from from a lawyer to seize whatever you're doing or pay a fine. So this is actually not even has never reached a court that, and that the criticism is for the German transposition that this is not covered. So the experts here on SLAPP, can you comment on that, whether that is like a common trend? Is that something that's in the EU regulation, this extra curriculum, however call that, so this outside of court area of SLAPPs, and are there good cases where this is covered? Maybe Daisy going in there. Who can answer that?
I was hoping that someone else might be able to jump in on this one. I will welcome any hands up from some SLAPP experts in this respect.
Futura, can you, what does the SLAPP directive says actually on the matter when it not reaching court? So it's just letters from lawyers and something like that.
The biggest difference between, sorry, I didn't take the floor because I felt like I spoke quite long. So the biggest difference in the two, in the directive and the Council of Europe recommendation is A, the EU directive covers only cross-border slabs. So that is very limited. But sometimes the European Commission, they are very careful not to tell member states what to do and how to regulate internal things. Whether we agree or not with that, it's too late because the instrument is in place. And the second, while the Council of Europe recommendation covers all types of slabs, so it says to a member state, to a country, address all type of slabs, not only cross-border. The second difference is on the type of slabs. The Council of Europe recommendation covers also the initial threat, whereas the EU directive is silent on that. Now, I had the privilege of serving in both expert committees. I'm one of the co-founders, co-drafters of the recommendation, and we had a lot of discussions about it. And it was inspired quite a lot from what happened to Daphne and in Malta. Because the reason why these initial threats are covered are because sometimes, from the perspective of the media outlet or a civil society organization or an activist, it means that you already have to invest time and money, even if you're not sued. To give you an example, Dunwatch is a very good investigative small media investigative media outlet in Denmark. They wrote about how a company, a Russian company, is evading basically sanctions, and they're doing business in Europe. So a very important an investigation with public interest. As a result of that investigation, a Moscow-based law firm contacted them and started to send at least five threatening legal letters. They spent months in responding to that. They had to hire lawyers to understand what are the consequences potentially in UK and what are in Denmark. And they had to respond to these letters. They had to make sure if they need to make any correction or not. So there was already a lot of time invested. The idea behind the Council of Europe recommendation to cover also the initial threats is to provide a legal assistance when is needed, and also some sort of compensation as a victim. So if you receive legal letters, I don't know, for months on or years, and eventually there is a lawsuit and you go to court, the idea of the recommendation is that those threats in itself make a slap. So it would be easier from the judge from the perspective of a defendant to explain to the judge, look, this is not just something one lawsuit because we did a mistake. It's a whole strategy, and the idea is to shut us down. So that's the biggest difference, and that's why I go back to my initial point on the quality of legislation. Now, we understand that it's not easy to address this with a piece of legislation, but member states have in place various ways of how to address it. To give you, I am from Kosovo, so I just give an example from a very small country. In Kosovo, the parliament amended the law on legal aid, and it included journalists as a special category. So most of journalists can benefit from legal aid directly. There is not much appetite in a lot of member states, EU member states, to do this, but there are ways to support victims even if they don't have an actual lawsuit.
Very good. This answered this very well. I have Tina here, and I'm actually adding another question to that, just to maybe to also paint the picture a bit here. We have a question from the Deutsche, or like a comment actually from Deutsche Umwelthilfe, which is a very big and very active NGO here in Germany. And the person writes, "We are dealing with a slap case at Deutsche Umwelthilfe as well, without any court involvement as of yet. We were asked to pay €7,500 in legal fees within 5 days. Otherwise, €750 in collection fees would be added. We have ignored this for now and will go to court if necessary." Just an example how that kind of things work, for example, in Germany. Tina.
Yes, I just wanted to add a comment to what Flutura said. In fact, in Malta, because slap threats are not covered in the legislation, we have set up a legal program with a lawyer. Because obviously, it is important to keep in mind that when you have smaller countries like Malta, for example, like Kosovo as well, media organizations are very small. They're under-resourced, they're under-financed. I mean, most of the, if not all, of the media organizations in Malta do not have in-house lawyers working with them. So if you'd have to get a slap threat or a libel threat, a legal letter, they have to outsource legal opinions on how to deal with that threat. We did create a couple of years ago a legal program where we have a media lawyer who offers free legal advice to journalists, both pre-publication, so before publishing a story, so that lawyer can analyze the slap risk as well before they publish, or maybe see how to limit that risk as well, and also offer support after the story is published should a threat arise. And I think the program has helped a lot in Malta. We have seen a decrease at least, in slap threats and slap cases in Malta. I mean, I don't know if it's because of the program we're offering, but we don't have many, media organizations in Malta. There are, five independent media organizations. And we think the program has kind of created a more safer environment, for journalists here.
Thank you. This actually connects very well to Luisa's questions here, and which I just read them, and then also Flutara, I will take you in. I think you will be able to answer that as well, and then I will also get Navoika in here as well. So Luisa asked, as a law student currently writing a research paper on SLAPs against environmental NGOs, I would be interested in hearing your opinions on the following aspects. One, how would you describe the impact of SLAPs on democratic participation and civil society? And she mentions chilling effect, etc. And second, what would you say are the biggest limitations of the new anti-SLAPP directive, and what would you suggest for improvement? I think the second one, Flutura, you have covered quite a lot, actually, but the first one we haven't covered so much. I think Tina mentioned, that the cases are going down, and as well. But I'm also wondering if you offering kind of the SLAPP checks is checks beforehand. Is that then also a way also to chill down journalists so they're not writing as critical as clearly as they would before? So invite hands if you have an opinion on on the chilling, and want to take Futura with her hand now, and then maybe Nawoika, and then anyone else who wants to go on this.
Thank you. So I think we can go on and speak for very long on the negative impact SLAPs have on democracy, on freedom of expression and media freedom and public participation. But if I were to reduce on one sentence, it would be that because of SLAP, the biggest risk is that we will have less information, which is in the public interest to be shared. And for me, this is, I think, the biggest motivation on a personal level to engage on this topic and to dedicate half of decade to this cause. The fact that because of a legal threat, a journalist decides not to write about something or decides to remove something from online, I think is the biggest risk. And privately, many journalists across Europe would say, look, we know who goes after journalists legally. We are just more careful when we write about them. And if we have other topics, we go for other topics. So that means that if we didn't have these instruments, and again, we can discuss whether they're weak or strong or whatever, that would mean that this risk would continue. And I think we have not succeeded entirely to stop SLAPs. That would be highly deserved. We would love that, but we're working towards that. But I think it's now a threat that is recognized, and a lot of people in different sectors are informed. On the limitations, I said the directive addresses only cross-border SLAPs. Again, for non-lawyers, if there is an article published in Malta about a businessman who operates in Malta but is from Bulgaria and operates also in Bulgaria. Currently, you can sue in both countries, in Bulgaria or in Malta. And sometimes they would sue a Maltese newspaper in Bulgaria just to make their life miserable, to add more cost, more time, etc. And we have concrete examples. So the directive limits this abuse of the possibility of suing. The domestic SLAPP, the Council of Europe instrument, it means that internally judges can dismiss domestic SLAPs much quicker. I want to mention also two things because I think the question came from a law student. We have only few media lawyers in Europe working on defending journalists, and we really need people who study and work in this field. We are a small group of lawyers working for non-governmental organizations. I know it's very sexy and attractive to work for a big corporation to earn a lot of money, and everybody has a right to do that. But just to say, we really need lawyers on our side. We're dealing with powerful entities who have an army of lawyers. and for them it costs nothing to file 10, 20, 100 lawsuits. And we are a very small group on the other side, so we need people to join. And finally, the Council of Europe, and I collaborate a lot with them, is doing amazing job in training judges, lawyers, prosecutors, and police officers on SLAPs. I'll share some resources online on training modules, but this is the next step after the legislation. Then we need to help build capacities of legal professionals how to recognize a SLAPP lawsuit.
Thank you. I wanna before going to Casey, wanna get Navoika here as well, because I was wondering that question. You know, you faced that, you resisted it, and you won against it. But did it actually change how you do activism in the areas where you are involved? So does it have a chilling effect? Do you change your strategy knowing about SLAPP? SLAPP and what happened to you after the experience, and do you feel with other allies, other communities as well?
Thank you for that. I feel like I'm speaking from a very privileged position to be able to answer no, because I was really encouraged by Helsinki Foundation of Human Rights, who are representing me, to just like keep going and go even stronger. But I realized this might not be the case. Like, if it weren't for them, I would be terrified and I wouldn't know what to do. So obviously this chilling effect would work, because even if I would want to fight, just getting through this lawsuit and understanding what they're accusing me of is like a whole new level, because there's like a specific language that is written in and stuff like this. So yeah, I feel like I would just add to that that I think the chilling effect is mostly on the smallest ones, right? The smallest actors. So like this is the thing. When we have the support of bigger organizations, then activists like me can be brave, right? When it comes to newspapers, one thing about my case is that a year before I was sued, I wrote an article where I also mentioned that gas systems and other lobbies, because this was an article about the European network of transmission system operators for gas that are lobbying in the EU for pro-gas legislation. I'm also explicitly calling them criminals, and even like I'm saying it directly, whereas in the article that I was sued for, I'm just quoting an activist who participated in an action that I'm writing about. And so this first article the year before was published in a major, like one of the main newspapers in Poland, and I was not sued for that. And they don't even mention that in the lawsuit that followed the year later. So it really looks like they knew that this first newspaper that's huge, they would be fine. They probably have their own lawyers, but they really decided to go for the smaller, the green news. So the smaller, more like activist led, with more like radical values, news outlet. So I really think what this does is kind of silence the most radical voices. And I'm saying in this context, radical as a positive thing, because we're living in a world where like fighting to be on a livable planet, not destroyed by climate catastrophe, is radical. So in this sense, the radical voices are being silenced. So another interesting aspect of this is where we were fighting against a pipeline that was supposed to be built out, and they cleared the whole forest, not Nature 2000 site, to be able to build this pipeline, the same company, Gas System. And we had this teenager who lived in one of the municipalities where the forest was cleared. She wrote a whole like letter that she was crying after this destroyed forest, and we wanted to get her letter published in the local newspaper. And the guy said, "This is great, we're gonna publish it, but first, because I need the plurality of voices, I also need to ask the spokesperson of Gas System to give their opinion." And of course, that piece was like, gas is great, it's amazing, it's so much better than coal, it's actually eco-friendly and blah blah, you know? And then what Gas System did is also buy out like sponsored articles in all the local newspapers of all municipalities that this pipeline was supposed to be built in and is currently being built, unfortunately. And then they didn't ask us for our second opinion, you know, because they paid for it. They have the capacity, they have the funds to pay for a sponsored article. So there was no need for plurality of voices there.
Thank you. Yeah, I think as I think Flutura said, is just they will always find ways to go around. But this is again, this is again, this is the old the beginning and of the fight's not the end. Casey, on that, and then we are looking at the clock, so we need to wrap up after that. And I want to actually get, I missed someone, so Casey first.
Jeff, Louisa, I love this question. Thank you. And, you know, I've said this, that standing up to the bully works. But I agree that that's a privilege. And Greenpeace International is able to do that. We have a certain risk appetite. And, you know, we have a team working on risk mitigation that not everyone will have. Sana and I are working on a project called the Resistance Files, where we will be publishing different stories of individuals that have been slapped or faced intimidation, criminalization, because they stood up to bullies. And what we see is, you know, we see students, we see farmers, we see landless workers all being targeted and different consequences to them. Some have been disowned by their family. Some can no longer get jobs because now they have this criminal record that they're not able to, you know, clear. So yeah, there is a chilling effect. And I think that the context is very critical, and it depends on the ability of someone to stand up to bullies and our ability to support different groups and come together as different coalitions in solidarity for others that are, you know, facing these types of slaps. Back over to you, Max.
Thank you. And I wanna bring in Ruby, actually. Ruby, so because because you didn't have a statement, I actually didn't call upon you to and you also didn't raise your hand. So I'm now just giving you a question to be able to introduce you, because you were instrumental also in setting up this webinar. So Ruby Silk, Senior Communications Officer for Environmental Law and Justice at the European Environmental Bureau. And you can maybe say a sentence about what that is. And I want to give you one of the questions here that that came as well, whether any groups and any areas are specifically endangered by slaps. And you're working for an organization that, you know, does a lot of environmental work. So do you see that, you know, we're talking a lot about the fossil backlash, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's so much resistance against the Green Deal. And just today we saw the vote on the CS triple D, like the due diligence law and everything. So do you see, like, is like the fossil backlash we are seeing against everything that, you know, was achieved in the last years, do you see that also covered with slaps? So are the on from the environmental point of view, is that part of the backlash?
Hi, yes, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak. So I've been working with the Case Coalition for the last year, roundabout, so I probably am not, you know, as well placed as some of my colleagues to speak on this, but I definitely think we're seeing more and more slaps against environmental activists, environmental defenders, whether it's journalists or civil society organizations, members of civil society organizations. It's often like we're seeing it against individuals as well as organizations at the same time. I guess because targeting individuals is much scarier, and that's what really causes this like chilling effect. And I do think we're in an interesting moment where the environment, sort of atmosphere for environmental action has shifted and has become much more hostile. So I think it is really important to keep an eye, to make sure that those working to protect our environment are particularly protected against slaps in law, and that the directive is implemented robustly across Europe. Because yes, as we see kind of a more hostile environment for climate activism and environmental action, I think the threat is only going to get worse.
Thank you so much. I think that was a very, very good point also to close on. Even it was a bit bleak, but I think we saw today that, you know, the standing up to the bully, as Casey put it, you know, that works, you know, and we should all do that. And there are so many people already asked, do we get all the links from the chat? Yes, you do. We copied the chat, of course, and you get all the information. That's quite a lot, actually. That's enough for a whole email. So we're gonna send this around to everyone who registered and put it on the homepage and with the recording, so you will find all the information from tonight. And I think maybe to also very important points, like in which climate we are. I spoke about the fossil backlash. Also, we are in the middle of the climate conference, where ambition seems to be a very bad word nowadays. The best way is to do nothing and just don't disturb anyone. And I think as we heard today, slabs are often used also in that regard. And this is especially when we look at the World Climate Conference, this is such an important topic. And if we want to win this fight for climate justice as well, I think it only works if we also win the fight against slabs and do more there, especially as legislators. And I think that's super important. I thank you all for bringing us here together, creating a coalition, and a feeling that we're in this together. We at Europe Calling, we will be back probably on the 26th of November, which will be a kind of summary of the World Climate Conference with some climate scientists and civil society and also industry, like green industry leaders. Be very interesting, 26th of November, if you want to pencil it in. And I'm sure we're actually going to be back in that space on that topic, because it was very interesting. There's a lot of the things happening. We want to definitely hear how Casey's the lawsuit against energy transfer turns out, and all the others. So thank you so much for this evening. Thank you all so much for listening and contributing. Thank you to our two amazing interpreters, and have a good evening, everyone. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for the invite.